Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and with me is our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hey, everybody.
Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And we have a special guest with us today.
Ooh.
Yeah, you've heard him before. He was on the Cliff Bar team episode when we talked about Crit Racing 101. You can check that one out. Pete Morris is with us. What's up, Pete?
How's it going, guys?
Yay.
Is that going well? Yeah. Yeah. If we were radio.
Play the applaud music.
Exactly, right? Yeah, if we were radio guys. So, Pete, for those that don't know and those that haven't listened to that Crit Racing 101 podcast or haven't seen him in Peloton Magazine, they've been doing a whole video series on your team this year.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
They've been following us around, I think, so far as Athens, Tulsa, and Boise are out so far. And Vancouver, Gastown Grand Prix is still coming, and so is Iron Hill Twilight.
Sweet. And for those that don't know what Pete looks like, Pete looks like Thor. So if you've seen the guy with the very long in the Cliff Bar kit with the long blonde hair and big beard, and he's a big guy too, that's Pete. So how much do you weigh right now, Pete?
I was talking about on the Saturday ride, I think I weigh 195 pounds.
We need to DEXA you.
Yeah, we do. Good. Yeah,
we can do that.
Yeah, okay.
What do you think your body fat is, DEXA? Do you know DEXA is usually a lot higher than
I bet I'm 12. 13-14% to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Where are the veins in your arms then?
Pete is pretty lean. Pete is pretty lean. Because I'm what?
You do it in the morning though.
Chad, what were you at with the DEXA last time?
What did I get down to? 11?
11, 12, I think.
7.1?
Yeah, 11.1.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and I'm right around there too. So, yeah, that would make sense actually. I bet Pete's right around there.
Sounds about right.
And then your FTP?
Maybe 410.
410. Nice. Goodness gracious. So I just did a VO2 workout and it was six 3-minute efforts and they were at 350 watts. I can't imagine.
It crushed you.
Well, yeah, and it destroyed me. I came out of that room crawling, so I can't imagine
some
that.
Tempo work for Pete.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, cool, man. It's good to have Pete. We're going to have some questions specifically for Pete that you guys have submitted via Snapchat. So thanks for getting those through. And then we have a bunch of other questions to get to as well. So the first one that we will go with right now is Jim's question. And Pete, he says, how do you travel with your bike when traveling to events like the stage race you did in Nicaragua? And he also mentions that he loves your article in Road Magazine, by the way. So go ahead. How do you travel with that thing? What do you do to carry it?
So I've been told a couple times that cardboard boxes are the safest on the airplane. So the flight, or, you know, all the agents take the best care of the cardboard boxes because the big plastic boxes, they stack stuff on them, they throw them around. And so I've actually had really good luck, knock on wood, that I've done cardboard for the last 3 or 4 years, probably. And that way you can always get a box at a race. You can throw it away at the airport if you need to. When you're fitting five guys in a car, it's real easy to not worry about the box. So I've had good luck with that. And I think even in Nicaragua, I used a cardboard box.
How do you pack it, though?
Very carefully.
But I mean, what do you put around the outside of it? It's not just cardboard in your bike.
No, it's like when your bike shows up, when you buy a bike, it comes with like styrofoam around the top tube and the chain stays and that kind of thing. So I keep a few of those and then some bubble wrap. And then sometimes I put my wheels in wheel bags just to kind of...
How long does that process take you?
I actually, before the drop ride on Saturday, I unpacked my bike from Iron Hill in Pennsylvania. So it took about 10 minutes, 5 minutes, something like that.
It's quick.
It's quick.
And you're practiced.
Yeah. Right. It's only putting on the bars, straightening them and, front wheel and pedals.
You take your, rear derailleur off?
Most of the time. And sometimes if it's a real reinforced box, I'll just leave it on. And I have a big, like, styrofoam pillow that kind of fits right in between the spokes and the rear derailleur, and that seems to do a better job.
That's a good idea, stuffing something in between the derailleurs so it doesn't get pushed in. I hadn't thought about that before.
So actually, it was magical. This time I pulled it out of the box and it was the best shifting it's been all year. So it's fixed. And it's perfect. I won't touch it ever again.
Yeah. I know that one thing people use too, if they're using a cardboard box or even if you're using a hard case, is you can go to any department store like Home Depot or anything like that. That's a store in the States for those who are listening internationally, but it's a hardware store and you can get like the foam that they'll use for insulating pipes or anything else like that. and you can wrap that around your frame, and then just some simple zip ties around that too to keep it nice and tight so then that doesn't get hurt. That's a good tip.
And do you just go to a shop and pick up one of their excess boxes?
Yeah, so usually you call on Saturday afternoon and say, hopefully they're open on Sunday, but you know, sometimes we'll be picking up boxes at 5 o'clock, like on the way to a bike race or something, mm-hmm. and then that way everybody can pack that night.
They don't mind. They're going to like it, right?
No, it's fun, and we all, you know, usually it's fun to check out the local bike shop scene and say hi and buy something, you know, t-shirt or whatever, because they're the ones helping you out. So
yeah,
it's saving us, you know, over the course of a bike racing career. I mean, it's I've used a lot of boxes.
Yeah, no doubt. We just got Bikened boxes, the Jetpack ones, and from what I've heard, the worst thing to send your bike on an airline is a hard case.
Yeah.
Because it just looks like just a random hard case, and it looks really durable.
Bomb-proof,
but they're
yeah.
pretty flexible. Then cardboard boxes are generally a little more safe because they look less secure. And then those Bikened bags are usually pretty safe, or Evoke makes some. And those ones that are specifically built for bikes that are they're not soft bags like the Sycon one, but they actually have a metal frame and a structure.
They look soft from the outside.
But they look mm-hmm. soft. Yeah. Exactly. So
I don't think that the guy loading the plane is really like, oh, that one looks softer. So let's like keep it, be nice to it.
I've never seen them ever handle
honestly,
a bag with
guys.
Care, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah,
it's true.
That's what we read though in articles. In fact, Cycling Tips,
all
I think.
Marketing.
Yeah, Cycling Tips had an article about this, about like which ones are best to take recently.
So I think did we get a pro discount on Bikened?
We did.
Okay. So yep. Everyone knows. But so we just got three of them. We kind of like them because they fold down small. We don't have any deal with them. They're like, we just got a pro deal.
Yeah.
But they also have a little chamber on the outside you can fill up with air, which is mm-hmm. the really cool part. Because mm-hmm. I used to have another soft case and I would put bubble wrap in there and I'd always be afraid of my carbon wheels getting crushed on the outside.
Yeah.
So being able to pump it up with air and then it folds down really small, which is better than my last bike case because that it just... It's like, you know, gigantic. I kept it in my attic and I'm like, I couldn't get it through a hole in the ceiling.
This would slide under a bed, even a high couch. It would be, it's they're pretty easy to store.
Cool. But we haven't used it yet. So hopefully it's great though.
Yeah, we'll find out after.
We'll keep you posted.
I do have one teammate who uses a Pika case, which is the undersize. So I think, don't quote me on this, but I think if you have a 56 centimeter top tube or smaller, it's undersize when they measure it. So you don't pay for your bike check.
That's the way to go.
That can be tricky because some airlines, regardless if it's a bike,
so
they'll charge you a bike fee, right?
The phrasing.
Bike parts, man.
Yeah. Bike parts. Like a, you know, a massage table or a, you know.
Yeah. Gotcha.
It's not a bike. It's just a couple bike parts.
Yeah. Bikened should have rethought their brand name when they made that, right? It should have been like medical equipment and something like that. Yeah. That would have been better. Next question for Pete. As we mentioned, we said you look like Thor. Where'd you get the nickname?
You know, I kind of grew my hair out as a joke because I was getting older and my hair was getting less impressive. And so I was thinking, well, you know, this is probably my last chance before I'm bald to have long hair. So let's see what happens. And then I think, you know, if you're just a big blonde guy, I think that's the real connection.
Yeah.
And then it's really easy for once one person says it, pretty much everybody adopts it. So it spreads around the course and then it's over.
Yeah.
And so I'm pretty sure very many of the other cyclists that I race with don't know my real name.
They just call you Thor.
Yeah, they just call me Thor.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'd go by that. I wouldn't stop it. What size kit do you wear? That's another question.
I tried to, this year I went from large skin suits to medium skin suits because after a whole season of racing, the large wasn't baggy, but it wasn't as good feeling at the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So the medium was a good call, but if I don't get help putting it on, I pop my numbers or I can't do it by myself. How about that?
Yeah. Makes sense. You have to have good teammates. Do you get custom kits made or anything? Because you are a larger than average cyclist.
Yeah, I'm big and I was the wrong ratio, we called it. I had to wear a large jersey and medium bibs because that's not what you want a cyclist to be, obviously.
Yeah.
And so this year I swapped to all mediums all around and it's hard for me to get into my pockets, but I don't really do road races anymore. I think I say I accidentally did one this year. So one road race made it pretty painless and I just wear a skin suit all the time.
And to clarify, you've just been doing criteriums this year.
Correct. Yeah. No road races take a long time. They're not as exciting for me, at least. And really the problem is that the real variation in intensity. So I can't go easy, then hard, and easy and hard. That's really hard on me. So, but if it's hard all the time, I'd have a much better time with that.
And you can depict that with your Ethereum. That's cool. Another person asked, why do you have the beard and long hair? It's got to make you less aero.
I think I talked about it in that magazine article that just came out. And I said, the writer we were working with was really interested in that. She was going, you know, what do you think about that? And I said, well, if we went to Specialized, because, you know, they're the ones that make the video.
Right.
I said, if you line up the kids yelling my name along the barrier because I have long hair and a beard versus shaving me and having no kids, I bet I'm going to pedal harder
with
the kids, and that'll outweigh the aero benefit. So it's not exact science, but in my experience with people yelling and cheering, you're going to do better than if I shaved my beard and my hair.
Yeah, Specialized did a couple tests. They did one with bearded riders, and they found that was like 1 watt or nothing.
Yeah, nothing.
It was crazy. Long hair, though.
Also, his beard is pretty... It was a substantial beard. It wasn't like the guy just had stubble, but it was really... It wasn't as if it was Grizzly Adams. He didn't have a huge beard. It was pretty...
What about Pete's length, right? Well,
like I just trained it Pete's. This morning. It was a little bigger before today.
True for the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Man. And then for long hair, I believe you do get some if you don't... They did one with the woman, with women, and I'm not sure the actual results, but I know if the woman tied their hair back, it was like another watt or something like that. It was,
Yeah, it was very
minimal.
Couldn't
measure it.
Yeah, yeah, they had, I think it was a
man
low...
Man bun, Pete.
Like a, yeah, here we are.
It's true, but the man bun, if it's low and slung, so Peter Sagan has the, like, real tucked one, and I think that's, I'm sure they know, right? He knows what the best one is, and they put it really tightly up in his helmet.
Yeah.
And so that's hot, though. Once you have long hair, it's hot to have all your hair right there on the back of your head. So I think it's cooler for me, temperature-wise, and a lot of the time we're racing and it's 80 or 90 degrees, that the hair, it's a wash, or, you know, for me. And I'm sure I'm losing 5 watts or 10 watts or whatever.
Who stays really cool? Chad.
Chad does look cool, right?
Chad has no hair.
Zero. Like a millimeter long.
No, I shaved my head a few years back, and I was in the winter, and it was amazing how much colder I was. I'm surprised, actually, if I was a professional, like, if I was going to race Kona as a professional athlete or something, I would totally shave my head again. And because it's so hot with the hair. It's like insulation layer.
Yep. Makes a huge difference. And when we talk about efficiency with heat, that's a big thing. That's a great way for you to decrease your efficiency with little work is just to make sure that you're not cooling well.
Yeah. I shaved it, you know, 15 years ago and haven't looked back.
Yeah. Yeah. There we are.
Just works.
Well, you're looking good, Chad.
While the hair may be less aero, it doesn't mean it's slower. So, and then the last question, specifically, this is like 20 questions for Pete, but we're getting at more like five. The last one for you, Pete, Gino says he looks like a big guy. What adjustments does he have to make to his training since he is bigger? If you have to make any adjustments.
My philosophy is pretty easy in the scheme of things is I never worry about how much I weigh. Right. I think I talked about it in the last podcast that I'm always, even in the hilly races, like I just did the drop ride on Saturday and it has some climbs in it. And if I'm fully, you know, fueled for all my workouts, I never kind of have to bail on any workouts. So I always complete my workouts because I'm always eating. I never worry about how much I weigh. My like homeostasis seems to be about 195 pounds or 190 or 200, somewhere along there. But, my power always seems to increase, at least for me, enough that I do a little worse when I lose weight. So
how tall are you?
I'm 6'1".
Yeah, so, but you've got a broad build.
Yeah, I definitely don't look like a cyclist. Right.
And that's the thing. If you were to obsess about your weight and drop your weight down a lot, your power would probably really suffer. Your ratio may not be as high.
Right. I think so. A few years ago, I got down to 176 or something when I thought that's what I had to do to be a good cyclist. And I was very skinny. And I could go uphill pretty quickly, but not as quick as the really fast guys. So I kind of shoehorned myself into not being good at anything. Yeah. And definitely as a real cyclist, as a competitive cyclist, you want to capitalize on what you're good at. So for me, that's riding fast and more power and more weight. Fast and flat. And make that much easier. So 30 miles an hour is way easier as a 195 pound guy than it is as a 140 pound guy.
Sure.
That's smart. Just, you know, build your ratio or the makeup of who you are as a cyclist toward your strengths, right? It does make sense.
So back in the day, Pete actually, we used to live almost in the same house. When I moved out, he moved into that house in college, into my room. And we first started cycling together, and I used to beat you.
I was going to say, my first race ever was with Nate. He dragged me out to the Reno Wheelman race, and I think you beat me, and I got dead last in my first Wheelman CU race out at Boca Reservoir. But Nate was there. Nate was the one that brought me on my first bike race.
But remember back in those days, you always thought you were a sprinter?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then how did you, like, when did you
because that's
along?
Not what you are now. Really?
Not anymore, no.
You kind of look like you should be a sprinter, but that's not what you're best at. So when did you kind of figure that out? And how did you figure out what you're best at?
Well, for me, I was a sprinter. So different categories are different. I was better at different things. And so even as a 4 and a 3, I pretty much only had to be in the top 10 wheels and I would win the bunch kick. And so, but I'm just a big guy and I do have a pretty good sprint. The problem is at the high level, the sprint isn't the important part. It's being able to hang on the wheels and kind of rub shoulders and bump elbows for 10 minutes before doing that. And then really having a lot of go juice right at the end. And so the real sprinters in the races I do have, like, you know, 6 watts per kilo for the last lap and then can still sprint on top of that. So, you know, multiple minutes at as hard as you can go and then sprint after that. And so for me now, my strength as a bike racer is really my mental game. I'm a much more efficient cyclist than a lot of guys. And since I'm a big guy, I use momentum and things like that. And so it's much easier for me to roll at 30 miles an hour and kind of slowly break down other guys in the breakaway or whatever, versus in a sprint, if you mess up once, you're not going to win. And for me, I can mess up a few times and I don't win as often, but if I do get to the point where I have the chance to win, I'm going to capitalize on that. So I would rather trade, you know, 20 top 10s for one win a year. And that's kind of where I'm at. I would rather win once and the rest of the year come up short.
Can we hear some secrets? So let's say you're in the breakaway. I used to be, so a couple months ago I was your weight. Now I'm only 180 pounds.
Okay.
I'm skinny now, right?
Yeah, you look great.
But I'm 15.6 on DEXA. Yeah. I've got 6'6", 180.
Do you have abs?
I do.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you see him?
There's a great look of pride on Nate's face right there. Yeah, rightfully so.
Side note, lighting is everything. If you get some great top-down lighting and I kind of turn just right, there's like this.
It just ripples. And
it's in my bathroom. Yeah. And I like get into my master bathroom kind of thing. I got like the obliques down there. Like it looks serrated.
Change some warmer lighting too.
I know. And then you're in other lighting where it's just direct on and I'm all white. Yeah.
No, take it from a fair-skinned dude like me.
Big flat.
Lighting is everything.
Yeah. And one quick side note on that. I used to manage a clothing store. This is a very embarrassing admission here. I ran a Kenneth Cole and we used to actually have specific light bulbs for changing rooms. So don't trust what you look like in a changing room. Yeah. They're called vanity lights and they come in the box. It says vanity lights and it's not because they go into vanity. It's because they're the specific temperature to make you look
that everywhere.
So yeah.
New office, every room. Anyways, Pete. So let's say the four of us are in a breakaway.
Yeah.
And what things would you be doing to kind of, like you said that you want to keep your momentum up and wear us down. What would you do?
Well, here, what I'll do is
each one of us is on a different team.
Yeah. Okay. So since I was at the Saturday ride, right, that's a pretty good, that doesn't.
And sorry, the Saturday ride is just a local drop ride in Reno.
Yeah. And a drop ride means a group ride, but there's nobody's waiting for anybody.
Yeah, there's
and
a it's, go.
Essentially, it's a race.
Keep up or die.
You know the route beforehand and you know where the finish is and it's a race simulation. Everyone goes as hard as they can. There are tactics. It's rough.
The cool thing is that it is in locally, it's on lap, so you can get dropped and then come back on the next lap. Or
there are four flat-ish laps. You still get a good amount of climbing. Yeah. And then there is a connector up to four laps that are definitely climbing. They're really tough. And then a long run into a sprint finish.
So that's funny. That's a perfect example. So Jonathan called them flat laps, and I would call them rolling with two really serious punches for me. And so like my tactic, since I hadn't raced with any of these guys, I haven't done a drop ride in at least a year probably around here. Mm-hmm. And so my tactic in the, since there was 8 of us or 10 of us, it's still kind of a breakaway scenario. So my tactic was get a little bit of a gap going into the climb. So I just didn't get shot out the back right from the gun. Cause I didn't know how they were going to.
That's a super good tip, by the way. If you are bigger and you know you're going to get out climbed, get there first.
Or just not as good a climber as everyone else.
Get there first.
To the front,
Even if it's just first wheel, right? That gives you 10 bike lengths to fade. And on these 30-second kickers that we do on the first laps, that's a big deal. That's probably, I was trying to do some math. I bet it's 200 watts less. I bet I'd have to do the climb 800 watts with, if I'm last wheel, just to hang on. Yeah. Or 550, 600 to go from first wheel to last wheel over the top.
Yep. So you go less, you put out less wattage and kind of fade back on purpose to save energy.
Yeah, because that's the point where I'm least efficient on that whole loop. So smart. I would never do any, I would never attack there. I would never do anything extra there because that's going to hurt me way more than it's going to hurt anybody else.
Yep.
And so like Ben Raggins was there and he could pop off that thing like nothing. And so a couple times
Ben
is
like Jonathan. He's
weighs 145. Yeah, same weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's explosive. And so a couple times even I had the opportunity where I would hold my gap all the way until the top of the climb. And so some guys would catch me right at the top, but they're still going too fast. And I just did a lot of work to make it up the hill. So I'm not even gonna go with them, even though they're like, come on, let's go. Because that was the hardest part in the whole course for me. Like, I'm definitely not going to extend myself when I'm about to go to the part that I'm good at on that long, flat stretch.
Yeah.
So if it's followed that, the two climbs are followed by a 2.5 minute or 3 minute long kind of crosswindy flat stretch. And so that's probably where I'm going to be, other than the downhill, that's where I'm going to be the best. So I would never put myself in a position where I'm extended going into the place. I want to capitalize on what I'm good at rather than let other people dictate.
So to make that kind of like a broader thing for other people is like, so Jonathan, you or even Jonathan and Chad, if you're a small person, don't attack on a flat crosswind, attack on the hills. And if you're a big guy, flat crosswind is probably the best way to attack. Don't attack on the hills. It sounds like common sense when we're here. But I see it all the time in races.
Oh, logic goes out the window.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You run low on oxygen, your decision-making goes out the window. And there's a lot of the time, I think that, so the temptation for me in this situation, which I'm bummed I missed it. I was riding mountain bikes with kids. And to be honest, it was a great time, but I really wish I was at the drop ride. But if I was in that situation, that's what I would assume Pete would do. I would assume that Pete would be looking to capitalize after all of us little guys try to gun it and kill ourselves and try to get a gap up the short climb. I would assume that Pete's going to be ready to throw down after that, right? Because that's the move that you generally see. So a lot of the time you try to outsmart them and you think that, well, I'll be ready to catch them off guard coming into that or anything else. And the fact is, you have to look at your strengths, your weaknesses, their weaknesses, and just be realistic with it. Because if you try to outsmart them, a lot of the time in a situation like that where it's just down to pure power, it's going to be tough.
Yeah, I mean, like the smart move in that case would be knowing, maybe because it's a lap course, so you see what Pete's done, and you do the same thing he does, except you just grab his wheel. So he tows you up that big climb, and then you know you got a diesel to draft behind once you hit that flat stretch. Then when he wears himself out at the end of that flat stretch, you make a go at it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, interesting stuff.
Yeah, another really easy part was everybody's so excited after the climb that people kind of give it a lot of throttle to get back up to that 25 or 30 miles an hour. And that's the hardest part. You never want to be the guy bringing yourself back up to speed. You can get someone else to bring you back up to 25 miles an hour. It's really easy to go 25 to 27.
Yeah.
And it's a lot harder for that guy who just did the 30 seconds to bring you back up. So there was always willing guys that would bring us back up to speed. And then the last...
Also known as foolish.
Yeah, the last minute of the last minute of that stretch, it's really easy to bump it up to 30 or 31 or whatever. And that's,
Easy.
That's when people start having a lot of problems, but it's not as hard for you because someone already did the majority of the work.
So you're basically kicking them when they're down.
Yeah. Do you ever... I've done this before at Boca, which is a hilly road race that we have. Like, if there becomes a gap between me and the front guy, I just leave it there for a second and I wait for, especially if it's like six lengths, some other guy will go around me and like, you know, and do all the work. And I just kind of go in his draft and be like, thank you.
Yeah. I used to be, I'm still a nice guy. I used to be a much nicer guy and I would cover things. And and do more nice things in a bike race than I do now. And I think that was a big difference. I used to be a stronger cyclist than I am now, but now I'm smarter and a little meaner, yeah. I guess. But it's all about, you never want to do anything. You know, it's as sad as that is, every time someone does something for you, you just kind of won a small battle in the in the overall scheme of things.
Especially as if it's like before a downhill. So if there's some kind of like twisty, turny stuff and there's a gap, and I know there's a downhill coming up, like in downhill, like, you know, I'm always, you probably have to hit your brakes or you just like coast through everybody, right?
Yeah. Well, that's when you might as well, if there's a downhill, I'm always going to go to the front because no matter, even if I tuck, people are going to have to work behind me because no matter what, I'm going to go down the hill pretty much the fastest out of anybody there. So then all of a sudden they're pedaling just a little bit and I'm just coasting.
Yeah. Last time Pete and I raced together at Boca, you were upright and you were coasting and I was in my super tuck in your draft and you were pulling away from me. I was on the top tube.
I imagine like a Fabio, like hair flying in the wind as he goes down at like 50 miles per hour.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weight's huge when you're going down. One quick thing too. Sorry. I just thought of this. When I was actually racing Boca last week, I thought of this, and this is something that I see a lot of people do. They'll tuck when they're going downhill, and then when they hit the flats, they'll pop out of their saddle and they'll start pedaling. And generally, if it's a steep hill, it's useless pedaling. You're spinning at 130 plus RPM, you're tiring yourself out, and you could probably still be in that tuck, still resting and carrying on. And a good way, if you can see your Garmin there in front of you, know roughly where you top out in terms of cadence and speed in that top gear, and keep your eye on that. And when you get to that speed, then get it back up. But don't just get back up and start pedaling as soon as you hit the flat. You can run that out for a little more, especially if you're heavier like Pete, you can carry that momentum for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say I pedal much less than a lot of people do overall. And like part of that's how much I weigh, but even like on the Collin Loop, I can coast all the way down the hill and all the way up, and then I'll start pedaling once it's the flat. And even though I dropped down to 25 miles an hour, I still didn't pedal up a climb. And then you can stick it at threshold and they'll catch you. But those guys had to work to close down 10 seconds every time.
Perfect example of that is the Nevada City course. Because you come ripping down a hill, you go through two turns, and the less speed you scrub off on those turns is the more speed you can carry up the next climb. Mm-hmm. You can make it all the way to that first turn without pedaling if you do it right.
Yeah.
And those are the guys who still have a little bit of kick left in them that break away in the closing laps, can close stuff down. Either way, just have a little left when it actually matters.
For those that don't know Nevada City, it's actually, there's a workout called Nevada City in Trainer Road, and it's brutal. And it's more or less meant to be a replication of sorts of the type of efforts that you would experience if you did that. But for those that don't know about that race, you should check it out. It's pretty cool. It's when Lance Armstrong raced it back in the day, Horner and all the guys. It's a really cool event. So let's get into the questions. Let's do it. Let's look at...
Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, welcome to the podcast. Let's start it. All right. Let's go with John's question. He says, a question for your podcast, which I love. Thoughts on chocolate milk as a recovery drink? Is it legit science or just a marketing ploy? Thanks.
You want me to take it?
Take it, Nate.
Okay. So I've talked about this before, but we'll talk about a few different things and where I am right now. So after you work out, there's like this golden window where your body can take in nutrients faster. It's heard anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes. That's legit science. I've also read stuff that after 24 hours, just eating meals, glycogen goes back in the same way. I actually remember Pete on your podcast, but you're at, you were just like, you really like doing the recovery drink right after your race. He's going, yes.
Yeah. And I have a nutrition degree actually, accidentally. Oh, yeah. I got one.
We got nutritionists.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right, Nate. Yeah. No, it's I would say chocolate milk is both, right? It's a marketing ploy and it's effective for what it is. I would say there's a lot more effective things, but if it's chocolate milk or nothing, man, you're going to get 75% more recovery out of chocolate milk. So probably.
Before we get into chocolate milk, because I got the stats on that, just the idea of that window. So I've been struggling with kind of tired legs, especially with less carbs, which you probably, Pete, aren't getting as much because you're eating more carbs. I just, like last night, I ate a Little Caesar pizza.
I don't know how you do it.
I know it's a skill, right, Pete?
Yeah. It is.
It's a talent. It's an innate talent. But anyways, I am feeling better eating more carbs, and I think my legs are getting less tired, and I am now on the bandwagon of after my hard rides, I am doing a recovery drink. Okay, and I think, are you guys, Chad, are you doing a recovery drink right now?
Yeah, I was, but now I got to get back on the weight loss wagon, so I'm going to start trimming those back, paying close attention to what happens to my power all the while.
Yeah, I use, every time after a ride, although today I didn't.
And one reason why I didn't do it before too was for weight loss, just not the extra calories. And Pete, you do it?
Yeah, and there is some tweaking you could do if you don't want to gain any weight. Like you can go more BCA heavy recovery drinks, and that are just
BCA meaning branched chain amino acids.
Right. And so like I have like a magic mixture. So I do like depending on the ride, I'll do more protein with my BCA carbohydrate mixture. Even if I do not commute to work, but anything above 20 minutes, like I get on the trainer pretty regularly for half an hour.
Good man.
Know? Yes.
Yeah. And because I only have half hour windows and like I've done Star, which is that 20 seconds. I bet I do that twice a week in one go pretty often, maybe 4 out of 6 weeks or something. Cause that's my favorite. That's the one I can't get out of, outdoors. There's too much, whatever. It's the best training tool in one 30-minute block is that workout for me. And so I always take recovery after that because I'm thrashed after 30 minutes, right?
30 minutes of that hard.
Yeah. So things that will slow down a recovery drink from... So what you want is things to absorb as fast as possible. And the science behind it, there's anywhere from a 3-to-1 to 4-to-1 carb to protein ratio. Okay, so...
That's ideal.
Yeah, exactly. Ideal. So 10 grams of protein, either 30 grams of carbs or 40 grams of carbs, depending on which science literature that you do. The one that I have right now is 3-to-1 carbs to protein.
And everybody's different. So you can fine tune. You'll know whether you're a 25 gram, or,
How do you know?
Well, by testing. Trial and error. Right, trial and error.
By feeling better after your ride.
Yeah.
That's one thing I find that's a problem with this is I know that the placebo effect, and there's a lot of guys. So I wish I could double blind myself where I don't know. I need someone here to put an X and a Y in something and then have somebody else go get the X and a Y and administer it to me and then write it down.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm probably not going to do that. But the other thing that can slow it down. So we have the ratio and now you want as fast absorbing sugars as you can get. And the things that will slow that down are fiber and fat.
Correct.
And chocolate milk has a little bit of fat and fiber in it. I'm looking here. Online, it actually has the 3-to-1 ratio of protein to carbs, but it does have 2 grams of fiber, which seems weird. I didn't know that chocolate milk had fiber, and then 8 grams of fat. And online, you can look up and look at the different glycemic indexes and loads. So what glycemic index is how fast sugar or how fast something absorbs into your bloodstream.
So something with
which spikes your sugar.
So if something has a lower glycemic or scores lower on the glycemic index, does that mean it's faster?
No, it's
slower.
Slower, yeah. So like meat would have a very low glycemic index and glucose, which is like the measuring stick is 100. And that's like extremely fast, pure sugar. So I lost my place. Chocolate.
So I'm in a unique situation here. Nate's getting more information specifically on a chocolate milk, but I'm in a unique situation that, and this is something that I think that we'll touch on later on, but chocolate milk, while it may be good for you, I'm lactose intolerant.
Me too.
Yeah, that's a whole other issue.
And it's a really tough thing. So a lot of people, I think they feel pressured to take a recovery drink and they might even drink that chocolate milk. Mm. But if you're lactose intolerant, it's arguable that you may be doing even worse damage to yourself.
Yeah. So chocolate milk glycemic index is 49. So it's right in the middle. So that doesn't have a very high glycemic index of what you want. And I would argue that it's not the best. But if you're at some race and it's like, I'm at the 7-Eleven.
Like Pete said, in a pinch, that's a great way to go.
Yep.
Yeah.
But one thing you can do is you can actually buy pure dextrose powder, which is dextrose is the same as glucose, but it's made from corn. And it's sugar, but it's less sweet. It's really cheap. Bodybuilders do this. There's some Ironman products where you can just buy dextrose. It'll mix in water. And you can make your own recovery drink too. You can do that with some whey protein, which is also fast absorbing. Add something else that you want. I mean, the things that I'm buying are pretty much just that. It's dextrose, which has a glycemic index of 100, some whey protein, and then they'll throw in like electrolytes and some vitamins, but overcharge.
by a ton, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. And you can get any bulk protein. You can get yellow pea protein. You can get brown rice. You can get lots of vegan options, lots of whey. You can go different, you know, like I think I've noticed a difference with grass-fed whey and it seems to be easier on my stomach. I'm not lactose intolerant, but I can tell when I eat ice cream or drink chocolate milk and it's more of like a head congestion thing for me. Mm-hmm. So my recovery with this more broken down whey doesn't cause that for me. Mm-hmm. So everybody's a little different. And like, that's kind of the key to nutrition is everybody's different. And yeah. So finding what works for you in the scope of what's scientifically acceptable is kind of the magic.
Yeah. And it's difficult once again to quantify that perhaps. But the cool part is us as cyclists doing power-based workouts, we have a good situation to be able to measure performance and measure perception of fatigue or recovery or anything else when you are following a training plan, because then you have work to do and you know that work should be, you can look at an intensity factor and know roughly how difficult it should be. And you can try your best to discern that if you keep all other things constant. So
some other glycemic indexes, I'm looking at health.harvard.edu. So they've measured this. Orange juice, only 50. I thought that would be higher. Gatorade, 89. Wow. All brand, 44. Cocoa Pops, 77. Corn Flakes. You think Corn Flakes, you know, they don't really put sugar on it, but it's 81, right? Because that's pretty much just, you're just eating corn.
Those aren't frosted things? Those
that's not just frosted, yeah.
Oh.
What about, is there Coke on there?
Yes, there is. Coca-Cola, 63.
Okay.
So Corn Pops is more than Coca-Cola,
yeah,
which is kind of crazy. And then this shows you too that, okay, quinoa, 53. So that's got the same kind of glycemic index as
chocolate milk.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So recovery drinks, I guess all of us in here, Nate is kind of going through with this experimentation phase where he's trying to figure out, trying to hack a recovery drink to find which one is best.
No, I'm not really. So I'm taking First Endurance's Ultragen.
Yeah.
And I'd like to spend the time and do it, but I'm just buying it.
It's a lot
it
of
right
work.
Now. Yeah, exactly. That's what I get you, right? You could make it, and I totally could, but.
Yeah.
At first, I just want to see if. I'm not doing a very good experiment, though, because I have so many variables that I'm changing at once. I'm eating more carbs and more food in general. So now I want to keep my weight down around 180 to 184. And then I'm eating a lot more, and I'm doing the recovery drink. So. Maybe it's just me eating Little Caesar's pizza that's doing it, and Popeyes, and
yeah, no doubt.
Do you eat that kind of stuff ever, Pete? You're vegetarian, right?
No, I used to be. So now I'm like a opportunitarian, is what I call it. no, if it's there, I'll probably eat it. But generally, I'm pretty healthy. Like actually, when I walked in, I had a burrito bowl from Whole Foods, like, and I don't usually buy, like, I don't do cheese generally because cheese just isn't that good for you in the scheme of things.
Yeah.
So like it had steak and fajita veggies and guacamole and beans and rice and salad. And like that's a pretty standard thing for me. I eat a lot of vegetables and lean proteins, and that's it allows me to also eat a lot of cookies and donuts and things like that.
That's what I was waiting for.
Yeah. No, I used to eat more, but I'm older now. I just turned 30, so I just can't eat the quantity of cookies and donuts I used to be able to.
Yeah.
I know about it.
So I still eat. I had a cookie. I haven't had a cookie yet today, but I'm sure I will have one today. I probably don't go very many days a week without eating some sort of sweet. But I don't treat it as like a reward for a workout. It's just, you know, for a long time I did that. If I did a hard workout, I could buy a box of cookies and eat them, and I could, but it wasn't necessarily, I didn't earn them. Those are two different things for me. Yeah. Like I deserve one cookie a day, but it's not because I worked out. It's because I'm living.
Because I'm me.
Yeah.
Because I'm me. All right. Jonathan says, I'm starting to think about my training plans for next year already, as well as following the structured training plans or triathlon plans in Trainer Road. I also like to have an eye on the main performance metrics to monitor progress. In addition to FTP tests, are there other measures in Training Peaks or Garmin, and he means Garmin Connect, for example, that can be used at different periods to measure progress? I'm thinking measures like PA, heart rate, and then he throws out a bunch of other acronyms, but we'll all get into those in a bit. He also mentions peak power over a time period, et cetera. So that one kind of speaks to Pete a bit, but he says, I know I'm a geek and I should just ride, but this structure motivates me. Thank you. So, Chad,
didn't you guys just do an article on this? Like with power and heart rate and perceived exertion and all this?
Yeah, we have one up there. You can find that on the blog. Yep.
Blog.trainerroad.com. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, so there are a lot of metrics. I mean, so many so that it can just make your head swim. You could just kind of have to boil it down to what's the most effective measure of your training as it relates to your performance. I mean, anything that benefits performance is going to be useful in some manner or another. Some of these metrics, we don't tie a whole lot of belief to them because we've some of them are a bit trendy. Maybe they're backed by a really reputable coach. And the fact is they might not be as useful, or they might actually be misrepresentative of what we actually think they're measuring. And that aerobic decoupling or that pace relative to heart rate strikes me as one of those. So really it's just a question of, you know, find a metric that's meaningful and matters to you. You know, maybe you don't need to know what your hour power is. Maybe your 3-minute power is more important depending on the type of athlete you are. So you're a kilo track racer or something. It's all relative to what you're trying to improve.
Yeah. To measure progress, totally, like your PRs for how long your distance is. I was just, I know last podcast, we talked about how fit we've ever been, and I'm like, my FTP is kind of a little bit lower than maybe it's ever been. But when I was racing triathlons, I could hold 2.5 hours power way longer than I could right now. So although my FTP was the same, I was more honed towards doing longer endurance events. And then when I was racing bikes with Pete, maybe the FTP was around the same, but I was way better at like a 3-minute power. It was way higher than it,
yeah,
when it was. So you can kind of look at all your PRs for your max power output. And that's another way. So if your FTP didn't go up, but you're training for a certain type of race and that went up, kind of what Chad just said, that's also measuring improvement.
Yeah, those are the two things that I keep track of. FTP, of course, I keep track of that. And then the other thing is my PRs. And for my situation, which I'm generally doing shorter efforts with mountain biking and everything else, I usually look anywhere from, I'm looking at the 5-minute mark and down, and I really like keep an eye on those, even up to 10 minutes. But I try to do 5 minutes, 3 minutes, 2 minutes, 1 minute, 30 seconds, that type of stuff. Yeah. And I just keep track of that. And those are little carrots to chase sometimes. And they kind of let me know, oh, this is, I'm better than I ever have been, or I'm back to where I was last year, or whatever it may be. The one other data point that is neat to me, and I say neat, it's not, I don't put a whole lot of stock into this, but I do monitor my resting heart rate. And I enjoy that correlation that I see when I'm getting very fit to seeing my resting heart rate decrease compared to, for example, December, anything else when I'm taking some time off. But I don't put that isn't really like a sign that I'm getting faster necessarily. It's just a correlation that I enjoy, if that makes sense.
If your heart rate's high in the morning, do you adjust your training?
Yeah. So now I say that, but recently I had a Fitbit that I used for that. And a lot of people argued if it did valuable or did accurate RHR, resting heart rate, but it measured it its own way, but it did it the same every day. So that's all that mattered to me. But I smashed it on the tree, so it's completely broken. So I haven't been using that. However, yes, and that's usually what I do when I see that coming up. And if I know for like today, I had those VO2 max efforts and I knew it was going to be really hard. If I woke up with a elevated heart rate by, usually it's like 5 beats is usually what I look for is the minimum. If it's 5 beats, then I'm going to make an adjustment. That adjustment may be lowering the intensity, maybe picking a shorter version of that workout as well. But that's usually, I don't try to cut everything out unless it's way elevated.
I see that. Again, this would be great to do like I wish we could just clone you and try this out.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because I wonder if that could hold you back mentally too. You're like, oh, it's 5 up today. Oh, yep. I'm so tired.
Yeah, along those lines, I've totally actually adjusted my pass or fail sort of heart rate increase to 10, a full 10 BPM. If I'm 10 BPM high, then I know I'm not doing anything intense that day. But I used to bag it at 5, and I think I was doing exactly what Nate's describing right now, probably selling myself a bit short.
I bet I'm going to have to increase that threshold since having a child and since my life is way more variable than it was before.
Exactly. Pete, have you ever done it where you feel awful, like just horrible going into a race or something, and then have an amazing race and have power PRs and just nail it?
Absolutely. And kind of, you don't know until not even the first pedal stroke, but like half an hour in, you can be just crawling and there's no way you're going to finish. And actually, I have a kind of a funny story. I was racing the Littleton Twilight, which is like an NCC, so it's the high level UHCs there. What would they be? Like the Dodgers of cycling. They're the high paid. They're the best of what I do.
Best US crit team.
Best US crit team. So I'm a pretty notoriously bad mechanic. More or less, if I
put in your bike box,
I can do it.
magic happens.
So if I touch my bike, it's almost guaranteed to be worse. So luckily, at most of the races I go to, there's pits and mechanics. So usually I walk up and ask nicely if they'll fix my bike. So my rear derailleur was acting up, and I was getting a bunch of jumps around, and I could not. I'm good enough. I can tune a rear derailleur, not that well, but I gave it to him. He ended up using tools and stuff. I don't really know. but he handed it back to me after 10 minutes. He said, go take it for a spin. I took it. It felt amazing. Shifted great. So went up to the start line. And Littleton has this long stretch. So you're in your highest gear. And it's after turn one. So we accelerated into turn one, made the turn, got up to 35 miles an hour. I clicked down into my 11. And then as I went to shift up, for the turn two, so two turns into the race, I hit my shifter and the gears snapped off inside my shifter. So I was stuck in my 5311, two turns into a 90-minute race. That was pretty variable speed-wise. It wasn't a hilly course, but it was flat and fast. And so I was kind of thinking, well, like, I'm going to last 5 minutes, more or less. And so then I was actually able to have a pretty good race. I managed to average like 55 RPMs, but I would either be 50 feet off the back and not break for any of the corners, and just because my acceleration was totally limited, I could not accelerate at all, right? I was on one pace and that was it. So I either had to be off the back or off the front, and so that just meant I had to be really smart when I moved up. And so I've never been able, kind of my own limiter was, if I stand up five times during a race, I'm pretty screwed. So this time I stood up 200 times probably, and I was fine. I was able to do it just fine. So those limiters that you kind of artificially set, like I would have bet money that if I stood up 10 times in a race, I would not be able to pedal after that. And so then all of a sudden I did 20 times that.
Pete, you've inspired me. I think next race I do, I'm going to cut Jonathan's shifter.
I think that's a great idea.
That's not a great idea. Not a great idea.
Let me say this too. Yeah. It's over time, and this maybe comes as I age, but I've noticed that what I used to be able to accomplish maybe a 15 or a 20 minute warm-up has extended to more like 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And now I'm to the point where I can look down, I can almost set my watch by it, so to speak. The 40 minute point in any race, that's when I start to feel good. That's when I start to feel thoroughly warm, and I can cut into that with a good warm up. But it almost takes 40 minutes worth of race intensity before I really feel like I'm firing on all cylinders.
I mentioned this before too with my trainer road workouts. If I feel kind of like dizzy and weak, I look at the timer. I'm like, 20 minutes, I'll feel better. Just drink water in 20 minutes, and maybe that's all mental, but 20 minutes go by and I'm like, hey, I feel pretty good now.
This is like everything from parenting to self-discipline and everything else, but you decide beforehand, where your limit is on where you're going to decide how to adjust that workout or race or decide the fate of a race or anything, which is crazy, period. But go into something and don't just let yourself get emotionally frazzled by it. Know that, look, man, I may feel terrible, but I always wait until 30 minutes in. I always go until this before I really make any judgments on how I'm going to do.
This happens all the time with indoors, but obviously I did an outdoor workout on my cross bike yesterday and on Sunday. And during the first interval, I said, I'm no way am I going to be able to do four of these. They're 20 minute intervals. Yeah. I was like, you know what? That's dumb. Like, you shouldn't think that. You should never decide how your workout's going to go. The first interval, a lot of times, I think, is the hardest interval.
I fully bargain with myself as I work through workouts. If it's a 20 interval workout, even if they're just 1 minute intervals, I'm just going to go for five, and that's probably going to be my day. Yeah, get to five, it's like, oh, I can get eight, then I can get 10, and before you know it, I got five left, and it's like, oh, I can do five more.
Yeah, yeah. Become an expert at bargaining with yourself. And I think
make deals.
Yeah. Endurance athletes are awesome at that. At constantly making those deals with yourself. When you do that, it does give you just enough of a carrot to chase without going too far, but certainly don't decide the fate of a workout before you start doing it.
Well, long workouts are potentially overwhelming if you look at them from start to finish when you've got so much work ahead of you, but just chip away at it. Just you can't get discouraged. Just eyes on the prize, and the prize being, you know, that interval that's directly in front of you.
Yeah.
And not like, I think Chad was the one that taught me, but when we would go to indoor power, it's really the last one or two intervals that matter, or, you know, not matter, but they're worth a lot more than the other ones. So
yeah, it's that overload.
Yeah, it's overload. So if you can, you can back it off for an interval or two out of your five. And if it's the second and third one are at 90 and 95% and you can make it through the end, you did a lot more, you know, scaling back not 10% on the second one, which you weren't even tired for anyways, like doesn't really matter. So I end up doing that a lot. Like I'll play with my FTP on Trainer Road and dial it back. But I know that I really care about the last handful of intervals.
Yep.
And those are the important ones, because those are the ones that are really going to change.
Yeah, those are the ones that push limits and grow boundaries.
I did that very thing today. And you told me that on the workout text, Chad. You told me that now is when it really matters. Now is when we're making you faster.
Ever present. So,
yeah. All right. Bob, he says, working on the 40K TT plan. Says, in an event day, I'll have a kicker on location. What's the best warm up for an hour long TT? And then how long before the start of the race should I do it?
So, Bob, I think we've mentioned a number of times how subjective warm ups can be, but the rule of thumb is the longer the event, the shorter the workout, or the shorter the warm up. And then, you know, for something like a real short prologue, all out sort of effort needs to be a long warm up. Again, though, there's flexibility within those recommendations. So, as I just mentioned a second ago, it takes me, as I age, longer and longer to warm up. So I would probably do a longer warm up these days than I would when I was 20 or 30 years old. But for something like a 40K TT where it's going to be a steady state effort, I've done warm ups where they're 10 minutes of steady effort and then I just roll into it, knowing that not being warmed up kind of limits my effort in the opening minutes of what's going to be a long TT. And then there have been times where I've followed, you know, kind of like Team Skies protocol, where you do, you know, a ramping effort and then a hard 1 minute and then a hard 30 seconds. Or no, I think there's just ramps and ramps and ramps.
Yep.
Yeah. 320s. Or I do the same one, or the Sky one they posted on there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's effective. That's a
the
great
microphone so far away.
It's a great warm up. And that one's worked well for me. But there's no hard, fast rule to it. So obviously you want to be warm, and it's going to be influenced based on your approach to the time trial too. Something as long as a 40K TT, last thing you want to do is be raring to go and blow yourself up in the first 15 minutes. So you might not need that intense of a warm up. Rather, you can use the first segment of that time trial to get thoroughly warmed.
Yeah, there's one, we have three different warm up workouts, but as Chad mentioned, we've encouraged everyone to experiment with that. Use the workout creator, see what works best for you. We do have a steady state one. It's called Cajon. That's C-A-J-O-N. And that one's a steady state one. It has you 8 minutes below threshold, but not a whole lot below that. And that's a steady state workout that you could use. I've noticed that with a lot of people, they roll up to the start and they panic about rolling in and having to sit there and wait for a while. And it's interesting. I was listening to Bradley Wiggins, or maybe it was A Year in Yellow. I think his documentary there was in his book. I can't remember which one, but he was mentioning the fact that the reason that he liked to finish his warm up and know exactly, like, and just have exactly a set amount of time. And I think his was 3 minutes or 5 minutes before he's hit that start gate. It wasn't so that he could keep his legs moving until he got to the line, the guy would count down and that he would go. It was just mentally, so he knew and he had a routine. In fact, Wiggins and plenty of other guys this year at the Tour of California when we were there, and even when Wiggins won Olympic gold and everything else, he spent time sitting down before he went out there in that time trial. I think there's a misnomer that you have to keep your legs moving.
Yeah, people get too wound up if they have to sit around before a race starts. And frankly, you can stay warm for quite a long time. You know, I've had periods where I've sat for literally a half hour and still raced pretty well. And then I've had close calls where I warmed up like a minute before road to the race start, someone held my bike and boom, I'm out the door. Can't say one worked better than the other either.
Yeah. We're kind of, my discipline is funny in that there's not very many times I'm able to really warm up at the races. So like we ride at noon, pretty long, you know, an hour or 90 minutes, pretty mellow. And that's effectively our warm-up ride 6 or 8 hours before. Mm-hmm. And that's enough that it's still going to be painful, but it's just not possible. And that seems to be the sweet spot for a lot of us. If we ride 60 or 90 minutes at middling intensity with some work, but not much, that your body still remembers that you rode your bike 6 or 8 hours before that. And when the gun goes off, the first lap is hard, but all of a sudden everything starts flowing again. So, and everybody's different. So you could be between the two, or, you know, it's every, you got to find what works for you for sure.
Yeah. Nate, you mentioned the placebo effect earlier and how hard it is to separate between actual or effect and just, you know, perceived advantage that you're getting. And for me, with my warmups, I personally feel that the big advantage that I get is the mental clarity and calmness that I get out of having a routine, right? I like to start, and most of my racing does start hard, right? If I do criteriums, I'm usually always the guy to instigate things off the front, or if Pete's there, then I just
chase him.
Yeah, try to chase him. But I always like to start hard, and I like to be thoroughly warmed up for that. But if I'm honest, I bet that a lot of the benefit that I'm getting from my warmups is mental, which isn't discrediting that at all. That's the important thing. If it does prepare you mentally, then that's extremely valid, right? And that's something that you shouldn't discount.
Yeah, and you are rushing some of the aerobic priming process, which means you're going to dip more heavily into your anaerobic stores when maybe that's not a great idea, depending how much you're going to utilize them or rely on them later. Mm-hmm. So they're all small. There are small concerns to take into account. But these are, again, and it sounds like a lazy answer, but these are things you just kind of have to figure out through trial and error, figuring out what works best for you.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, let's go to the next question. This one is from Jeremy. He says, "Hey guys, I'm a Cat 2 mountain biker in Texas that has taken about a year off from racing and structured training due to the birth of our second child." Congrats, Jeremy. "Training with one was easy. Two is a whole different ballgame." Is that what I'm up for, Nate? Is it tough? Okay. All right. "Trainer Road has been essential in maximizing my limited time, and the podcast has been extremely informative. I tried to review the old ones to make sure my questions haven't been asked, so I apologize if these are a repeat. One of my main limiters is skill on the mountain bike."
I feel you.
"I live in a relatively flat area, and technical trails are 3+ hours away. I don't have time to get out to these courses to practice, so I'm typically only there for a race weekend, and in that situation, he's just pre-riding, then going straight to the race. So the question, is it even possible to build this type of skill without riding these types of terrain, or am I screwed, and should I just try to build as much fitness as possible to compensate, or, as mentioned in earlier podcasts, just work on skills like bunny hopping, wheeling, manual, and balance?"
Yeah, I'll kick this off. I'm sure we can all contribute. I don't see any harm in or any problem with learning skills off of the terrain that you're going to use them on. I mean, the skills are there when it comes time to apply them. I feel confident in saying they'll be what you need them to be. So while it might not be ideal, practicing this stuff elsewhere and then applying them on the race course is totally reasonable.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that in your situation, being away from any type of technical terrain, I think that paying attention to how you ride the bike is the key. So with a lot of new riders, when I'm riding with them, to get them to be better, more confident bike handlers to handle different terrain, my focus is just to get them in the right position on the bike and get them riding with their core rather than their arms, right? Because most people on a mountain bike or a cross bike or anything else, as soon as their traction starts to turn away from what they experience on the road, their natural reaction is to grip hard with their hands, and suddenly they're just riding their bike fully with their shoulders, neck, head, and arms, right? Instead of having a balanced and strong core. When I can get, and usually what I do is I have I work with a lot of kids in a high school league here and younger kids even, and I have them ride a whole loop, and they'll ride with only one arm on the bars at all times, right? And they'll shift that around, they'll change which hand, but the goal or the rule is you can't have two hands at once on the bars. We'll change this on a descent or anything if it's too tricky, because we don't want people going down that way, but the goal is to spend more time doing that. And what happens when you let go with that one arm, you instantly clench down super hard with your hand and you feel really, really sketchy when you're riding one-handed. So then the next bit of advice, once they've done that, is to relax their hands so that their fingers, they can wiggle their fingers and their hand is just resting on the handlebars. And then subconsciously, without them even knowing it, suddenly they're riding with their core, right? And then you bring that to their attention, then they focus on it. If you are riding a mountain bike, and in your case, a mountain bike, and this helps with road too, massively. Chad is a really good example of riding with his core. He's smooth over bumps and anything else that comes up. When you do that, you're going to be so stable and confident on your bike. If you ride with your arms clenched down and tense, you're going to be very unstable on your bike. And Pete can speak to that with crit racing for sure, too.
Yeah, and it can also be argued that you pick up better skills when all you're focusing on is that skill. When you're not concerned with the terrain, you're not concerned with crashing, you're not concerned with speed probably, because these are going to be generally low speed drill practice. You might be better off eliminating all the other, you know, challenges and just focusing on that single drill or skill.
Yeah. And I know we've mentioned this before, but Ryan Leach, he has some really good instructional videos on how to get your body into the right position on a bike. And that's honestly the key. If you can get your body into the right position, you'll be able to handle the terrain that's coming up at you. Once you get out of position, that's when things start to feel scary. So if things feel scary for you on a bike, chances are that your body could be in a better position. And I don't know if I really want to get into exactly where you should be on the bike, because that might be hard to actually visualize if we're talking about that. But Ryan Leach does a great job of it.
Exactly. You can Google it too. There's a lot of attack position mountain bike. That's kind of what they call it. And it's all over the interwebs.
Nate, did you focus on that? Did that help you at all? What did you do? Because you were a new mountain biker, relatively speaking.
Still am.
And this and you jumped straight into mountain bike racing. You've gained a lot more confidence from the outside in on a bike. You look more confident on a bike.
Yeah. And changing bikes and stuff too, from fat bike to like a race bike, changed it. Practicing the skills are really good. For me, what will happen is, you know, I was racing on stuff that was too far and training on stuff that was kind of above my skill level. And then I don't learn anything. I don't progress at all. So, you know, what I should have done is moved to Texas and rode in like a flat area, but practice flat turns, off camber turns. That's the real difficult stuff. Mm-hmm. Like a bank turn isn't hard once you get used to the other stuff. And that's what you might see on the trail. But the other kind of stuff you can probably simulate. To me too, being so tall, dropper posts, and just recently getting really low. So I know a lot of people, the tack position, they have their legs just slightly bent and drop their heels. But I feel much better if I bend my legs more and get way lower on the bike. You've seen my saddle is, I think, what is it?
7.5 feet tall.
Yeah, it's very high.
Yeah, I think it's like 90 centimeters from bottom bracket to middle of saddle. So I'm much That's higher tall. Than other people. So when you take a turn, just the physics of that, of where my weight is, like as a lever against my wheels, it's high. And if I get lower, I feel much, much, much better.
Yeah, so just a couple key takeaways. So number one, ride with your core. Relax those hands. Make sure that you can wiggle your fingers comfortably. Even when you're going through technical stuff, your hands should not be clenched on there. So ride with your core engaged, and that's how you really control your bike. And drop your heels. That's one thing that Nate just mentioned there. The best way to drop your body, if you bend a bunch at your waist or if you bend a bunch at your knees, you're probably putting your weight off balance. It's more like an equal bend that you have through those joints, but the best way to do it is just to drop your heels when you're going downhill and to let those toes get closer to your shins. When you do that, it drops your body weight actually significantly. It drops it down a lot. So your center of gravity is lower.
On our new cyclocross bikes, I've been doing that and my heels hit my rear derailleur and my toe now, if I turn tight on a course, hits my front wheel.
Oh,
that doesn't sound like fun, right?
No, that's not fun. Big guy problem.
You think that the bike would be big enough, but I think there's just shorter chain state. I don't know why, but I've never had that problem.
All my road bikes, I hit my toes if I turn really sharply.
Yep, mine too. Yeah. So those are the tips. And the best thing that you can do, especially since you're going into unfamiliar terrain, don't let yourself be surprised by that terrain. And what I mean by that is just look further down the trail. So you live totally far away from the terrain. Don't worry about that. Just focus on putting yourself in the right position on the bike. And then once you get there, just look ahead. So it gives you time to pick the right lines.
It slows down the trail.
It really does.
And one thing that I've always fought for though, is like, look down the trail, but you're still like dodging little things. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at down at the trail and forward.
Yeah. So
like, how does that work? Cause it's not just, I've done that where I look just down the trail.
That's
and
bad.
And just nail. Yeah. So, and no one constant, ever says.
It's a constant scanning process. You're looking in front of your front
scan
wheel.
Scan down the trail. That's what people should be saying. And no one ever said that to me. They just said, look down the trail.
That's a good point.
Look down and like, I'm not looking down.
Yeah. And here's the concept behind looking ahead is that you've looked far enough ahead to recognize the obstacle, to already put yourself in a position where you don't even have to pay attention to what's going to happen when you get to that obstacle. Right. so that you don't have to scan down right in front of it. But in some situations,
yeah, everything is an obstacle. I watch you and you still look down on some things.
Oh, yeah.
I'm pointing
totally
at Jonathan.
Yeah.
The other thing that Jonathan and I figured out is the best way to like get you to scan down the hill is put poisonous snakes in your path. We have this hill called Peavine.
Yeah.
And there's rattlesnakes and bull snakes and rattlesnakes, but they look exactly the same. You don't know which one's which until like you're by, but they'll be across the trail. And supposedly, if you run over one, they can go fast enough and whip around and bite you.
Yeah.
But once we were on a ride, and I think we saw four of that ride. Yeah. But once we saw that first one, man, I was scanning up and down the trail. they blend in, too, so you really have to look. And every stick now is a snake.
It all is.
Your heart rate up.
Yeah. And then right now, all the leaves are dying, so the wind moves them, and they're all rattlesnakes everywhere. There's thousands of them, right? All right, and the last part of his question, he says, my primary power training is done on my kicker with Trainer Road. Is it necessary or beneficial to add power to my other bikes, mountain bike and cyclocross, to help quantify training load when training and racing outdoors? He mentions, I have a power tap wheel for my road bike already. I typically do intensity outdoor or indoors early mornings during the week, but like to get out on this on the cyclocross bike or mountain bike at least one weekend day, and we'll be racing fall mountain bike in the cyclocross season coming up. As a data geek, I want to see the numbers, but is it really beneficial for the cost associated?
Personally, I have it on everything, but you know, we're Trainer Road guys. So I think you're probably hitting most of it right now just by doing your inside workouts structured. And on your weekend stuff, if you don't want to be structured and just kind of get more, just kind of more enjoyable rides, that's fine. The only reason you want a power meter outside would be two reasons. One, to do interval training. So if you want to do some kind of, you know, 2x20s, whatever, the many types of intervals outside, or to track your training stress and like how much load is putting on your body, which I am very interested in that part of it. But that's not, you don't have to have that to be a fast racer.
I actually only have power on my Wahoo, and that's the only place I'm running power this year. And it was just sort of like a freedom thing, or you know, it was nice not to have a power meter on my bike. And I would say relatively just as fast as I usually am when I've run a power meter on my bike. And it works for some people and works for
And I'd say Pete's a unique case in the sense that you probably know exactly what certain wattages feel like or certain percentages of FTP when you're on the bike. Right?
Well, when you were talking about important metrics to know about, like my important metric is to know that I have to be able to go above 500 watts for 20 minutes a race or something like that.
Right.
Like that's really the only one that matters. Or
yeah.
And so that I can do 30 seconds on and off with no power meter and go get my workout in with no power meter on that, which is kind of a unique scenario.
That's why he's a pro. Yeah. It's I personally, like Nate, I enjoy having it, but in a race situation, if you're the type of person that is going to be on breakaways and you have trouble pacing, it can be helpful there. But in a mountain bike race, I've gotten this question a lot. If people ask me if it's even valuable on a mountain bike, and it certainly, I find the power data just as valuable. I like to have them on all the bikes, but I'm also very concerned with the same thing Nate said.
Yeah.
I like to know, with all the riding I'm doing, how that factors into my training load.
Yeah, and see, I think the best argument for having power or power measurement devices on all of your bikes is so that you can track your training stress. Mm-hmm. So if you're really intent on closely tracking that stress, that's probably the strongest argument for it. Yeah. But there are ways around that too. I mean, you can get to a point where you can estimate the stress of a ride based on its similarity to a workout you did indoors where you did have power. Mm-hmm. Or if you know, I worked for 3 hours at about 60%, because you know what 60% feels like. You know, It's pretty easy to tie a value to it, and calculating the TSS based on that is a pretty simple calculation. So you can, in a pinch, or you know, just to save some dollars, just estimate your stress and keep a pretty close handle on how much you're inflicting on yourself.
The other reason goes back to what we said before is personal records.
Mm-hmm.
Personal records the most in a race.
In a race,
yeah.
And I do. I love having the analysis after a race. I like to go through and see what I did.
Super helpful. But does it merit the expense of it?
Exactly.
Power I can't wait for Cross Vegas to see the difference in powers in all of us.
Oh, it's going to be interesting.
I'm going to say, relative to my speed, I'll have the highest power and slowest speed. Just because of the barriers. Not saying I have the highest power overall, but just it won't be
Yeah, yeah.
It'll be fun to break those down.
Yeah.
And that should be an interesting, actually, that will, I'm sure we'll talk probably ad nauseum about this one, but so sorry,
way
listeners.
More than you guys
want
to hear.
Yeah, but that will be actually really interesting because all three of us, we're
same
not.
Same bike,
we're
same not, power meter.
We're not that far off in terms of ratio, right? I mean, we're not in different zip codes or anything.
No, I am in a different zip code than you right now, but hopefully I'll
like ahead of us?
No, it's just different.
Okay.
It's behind, but it's just different. I'm 3.55 right now, so I need to get above 4, I think, to even be competitive in anything, which hopefully I can by districts in December?
December, yeah.
Yeah, that's I think reasonable. I can. That's like going to be 3:30 for me, and I think I can get there by.
Certainly.
Then. Well, cyclocross is one of those things that's all about efficiency, right? So if Nate's the most efficient. Exactly. And it doesn't even matter. Right?
I've been trying to practice canoeing the bike, and I like stomp every time. I kind of trip on my own legs. And...
Yeah, that's a really good point with cross. It's all about it. So I was mentioning to Nate, and we'll close that after this. But I was mentioning to Nate that so I've only done one cross race. I won my division, which I'm proud of. But in that one race, I was fixated on the barriers being a technical difficulty when they simply weren't. I was just fine getting over them. I may not have been the fastest guy through them, but it was just fine. But they were a different type of obstacle. If I were to look at my my effort, because I can't graph when I'm running, you know, I don't have power for that. But if I were to look at the effort and my fatigue every lap, it peaked when I had to get off the bike, run and jump over barriers, then hop back on. And I didn't expect that. And what that did was that changed. If you were to look at your lap like an interval structure, that threw a wrench into my spokes. So I didn't expect to have to do another interval there. In other words, another huge dose of effort, then come back. So I looked at the best guys racing that day and they were so smooth through the barriers. It wasn't that I was working so much harder to get through those things and going faster even than a lot of them, but they were just smooth through
there. Yeah, it's a break for them, right? Mm-hmm. That's how you can tell someone who's good is when they're capitalizing on all the breaks that the course provides.
Yeah.
And they're not losing any time. It's one of those things where you're so efficient that you're going to make the race easier on you and you're going to keep up just fine.
You ever race cyclocross, Pete?
No, I'm going to race this year. I'm going to race single speed though, because I live in Denver and there's actually the cross calendar is totally full from, I think, yesterday until like December 15th.
Wow.
But there's a lot of pros that live there and that's, I have a Cat 1 license. And so I just don't want to do that. I don't want to get really, you know, just rack myself for 21st place. Sounds pretty awful. So I'm going for a single speed. And that's one of those things I want to work on my efficiency. And so single speed really underlines how good you are at the handling and how efficient you are at the barriers and things like that. And for my style of racing, I'm a better racer if I'm more efficient rather than my power is always pretty similar. I'm not going to get that much faster, but if I'm just slightly more efficient, that's going to change. So I've heard some people tell me that it kind of recalibrates your brain racing single speed cyclocross to see more easy moments in a race.
Yeah, so that's, more easy grabs.
Right. So that's kind of what I'm hoping for. It'll be fun, hopefully pretty competitive, but
yeah.
You know,
you're going to be such a hit. Like cyclocross people love somebody that's like abnormal. That isn't the normal, like cyclocross, you know, or roadie guy. You're going to have a beard. So check, long hair, check, and you're huge. It's going
to
be awesome.
I have to come back and race cyclocross nationals here in Reno, right?
Yeah.
Since it's a home race.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the plan is I need one season under my belt to see how terrible I am and then assess and then come back for 2017.
Yeah.
Do they have single speed nationals?
They do. Yep,
they do.
So
to have you back on,
yeah,
after your champion.
Yeah. hopefully before then, but
yeah.
That's the plan. So that's January 2018.
Yep.
Right.
2018.
I got plenty of time.
Yeah. They have the. It's curious. They have the 2017 championships, but in January 2018, and then they have the 2018 championships in January 2017. That made sense. I might have just double spoke, but. Yeah. So, well, thanks, Pete.
Yeah.
It's good to have you here,
yeah,
man.
Definitely. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yep. And so the next racing is cyclocross racing.
Yep. I'm done for the season right now. So
cool.
no more crit races. And there's, a couple more videos popping out, but
cool.
Should be good.
And that's the Cliff Bar team.
Yep.
You can check them out on Facebook or any social channel. And you can see all their stuff there.
Yeah. And the Peloton. Yeah. The Peloton videos are a good time there. I think they're an accurate representation of
totally
what we do, which is nice. It's the first time we've had like this medium to go through and kind of reach people to show what it's all about, which is cool.
That's so. Peloton Magazine. And if you see Pete or any of his Cliff Bar guys, chances are they're all really cool dudes. So cheer for them. They're out there having fun on their bikes. They're not the serious jerk roadie guys that you may think that they may be. They're all good dudes. So cheer for them. Thanks for sending in your questions. Remember, you can do that by going to trainerroad.com/podcast. You can submit your questions there, see the latest episode, get all the information, and share it with your friends. You should do that, by the way. Everyone listening
to this.
What
about review? Because our reviews have slowed down. Yeah. We stopped asking for them.
We're begging. We're at 153 5-star reviews. We need more.
No, we're like 130.
We might
iTunes,
be.
iTunes, yeah, 132 might be. Or something. Yeah.
So we need
not
more.
That we're paying attention.
So yeah.
But who's counting?
So 5-star reviews. Please leave those. You can leave those on iTunes. Share the podcast with others. That's really valuable too. We really appreciate that. Yeah.
The bigger we get, the more cool stuff. We put more budget towards it. We have guest people like Pete, and hopefully everyone learns more.
Guests all the time, right?
Yeah, it'd be awesome.
Just need more. Yeah, because you were so expensive to get on.
Yeah.
I'll take that check after this, by the way.
So thanks so much, guys. And you can also use the hashtag AskTrainerRoad on any social channel you have. Find us on Snapchat. Send in your questions. Those questions don't have to be ones that are answered later on, a week later on the podcast. I answer a bunch of those ones live, or maybe Chad or Nate will answer them too. But you can send in your questions that way, and we'll answer them personally that way. You might even get a video response. So thanks for listening, everybody. Talk to you next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.